Hello, this is Meet the Writers with me, Georgina Godwin. Today's guest is one of Australia's foremost writers, winning the most prestigious Australian Prize for Literature, the Miles Franklin Award, a record 4 times. He's been on the Man Booker shortlist twice. His output of novels, children's books, non-fiction books and short stories is prolific, and the list of plaudits too long to list. His work has been adapted for film, television, theatre and opera, and he's published all over the world in many languages. In fact, we think it's 29 books in 28 languages. He's a fierce advocate for the environment, and he's been named an Australian living treasure. Tim Winton, what an honour to welcome you to Meet the Writers.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you so much for coming. You are notorious for not ever saying very much about your own life, but your 2016 collection of stories, The Boy Behind the Curtain, gives us an idea of the man and the child, I suppose, behind the words. And you say in the book that your life feels like a topography of accidents. The first to affect you happened when you were just 5. And I wondered if you could start by telling us a bit about your family and the world you were living in before that dramatic event and how it changed.
My dad was a cop. We lived in a kind of a new sort of state housing suburb that was being built or dredged from the bush around us every day. I mean, your suburb got bigger every afternoon. You come home from school and the bulldozers had pushed over more trees and they were building more streets. That was the sort of the raw nature of it. I am part of a settler culture, but in a sense, my childhood was a subset of settlement. We were making it up as we went along. But yeah, working class. Happy, as you alluded, we felt safe and secure. We knew who we were. It was very modest in terms of finances, but we had our place in the neighbourhood, and my parents were thrilled to be able to own a little brick veneer bungalow of their own. Well, it belonged to the bank, of course, but eventually, when they were older, it was finally theirs. I used to love going fishing with my father, mostly just to spend time with him. Our world was totally transformed one afternoon in the summer of 1965, I think, when my father, who was a traffic cop, a motorcycle cop, was knocked off his bike and he went through a brick wall of a factory. And his chest was crushed. He was terribly injured. Somebody saved his life by giving him a tracheotomy in the street and cut a hole in his windpipe so that he could get some air. So our father sort of disappeared from our lives. I was 5. My little brother was 3, and my sister was a babe in arms. She was about 6 months old. And, you know, he was this big, strapping, confident, nice bloke. And he'd roar up the drive at the beginning of a shift in his leathers and on his BSA. He was like a Viking, you know. He seemed indestructible. And at the end of the day or the end of the night, he'd come down the drive and kicked the BSA onto its stand, and it was, you know, the hunter home from the hill. All was safe. So when he was gone, when that accident took place, it was a terrible period for my mum because she had 3 little kids, and it looked as if my father survived, and for a long time it didn't look as if he would survive. He was in a coma for weeks in hospital. But it looked as if the best scenario was that he'd be an invalid for, you know, he'd be pensioned out of the job and she'd face this life of, you know, a much diminished future. I just remember it as a terrible, fearful summer. And I just gave up on the idea that, you know, the old man was ever going to come home, because everyone said, oh, he's in hospital, they're doing great things, you know, he'll be all right, you just got to stay tough. And in the end, I just thought, no, he's dead. They just haven't got the guts to tell me that he's dead. One day he did come home. For a long time, he was a different creature. He was a different, you know, his body was different. He was smashed. His eyeballs were red. He still breathed through this big plaster in his neck that whistled like a spinnaker. It was ghastly. I didn't know who he was when they brought him home. I just took all his cues because people kept calling him John. John, Johnny. I was like, John Winton. No, that's not John Winton. That's not my dad. If you like, it was the central wound of our family. We were living, I guess, some version of the Truman Show until then in happy, sunny, suburban 60s Australia. And we realised that I certainly realised, and I think Mum and Dad both realised that their lives were fragile, and all life was much more fragile. Something my father probably should have known anyway, because he was an accident cop. When we used to go to the police picnics at Christmas, you'd meet other kids whose dads were, quote unquote, in the job, and you'd say, "Oh, there's Billy over there. His old man's in liquor and gaming. So and so, he's in heavy haulage." You'd step around that family over there because they were always in vice. The old man was in accidents, which was a subset of the traffic office. But yeah, we grew up in a house of accidents. Accidents were our culture. We understood them. So Dad was going out to havoc every day and coming home and trying to leave havoc behind. But I think he was a different person after the accident. He eventually went back on the bikes, but I can remember being a little boy, maybe 10, 11 years old, and I always knew if the old man had been out on a fatal, as we used to call it when it had been a traffic accident, there was a death, he's back from a fatal. And he smelt of disinfectant and petrol, and a smell that I later in life understood to be blood. And it was a strange life to be in this very safe, nurturing home where Mum and Dad did everything they could to keep havoc outside the walls, out in the world, and they treasured safety. And I think after the accident, they treasured it even more. And Dad, in particular, was determined that the world of havoc wouldn't come into our lives. But yeah, you couldn't avoid bringing it home. And some nights I'd hear him weeping through the stud wall, and it was disorienting in lots of ways. But it was a part of my education. You know, I understood that there were different ways of being a bloke. Blokes had feelings, and they, even if they didn't have good language for feelings, they were licensed to cry like girls.
And it was when Christianity came into your parents' lives in particular, they became very devout.
Yeah, during that ghastly summer and the autumn that followed, Mum just couldn't get Dad out of bed and into the bath. I mean, that bedroom was the closest to the bathroom. The bathroom was tiny, I can't believe it. When I could see the dimensions of the amenities that we used to have when we were younger, the sprawl that we've got used to. But no, Mum couldn't get him out of bed, even in his diminished state. He was still a big fella. One day a bloke knocked on the door of some guy we didn't know, and he said, "I heard you're having trouble with your husband. Do you want some help?" Which, deeply strange thing to have happened. And I think my mum was quite resistant, and I certainly remember being resistant. You know, this guy was a stranger. You know, it was strangers who hurt my father. It was a stranger and a drunk driver that had caused my father his suffering. And so I didn't want to let this guy in, but we were desperate. Mum let him in. This guy used to take Dad to the bathroom and bathe him and close the door in my face, if you don't mind. I used to sit, well, they'd leave it ajar, and I'd sit out in the hallway, listen in, just keeping vigilance. You know, I was the man of the house now, so I thought. And they used to talk, and I used to hear the water. And Dad said, you know, that he always loved speed. He always loved being on the bike. He was just going fast and then pinching other people for going too fast. It was the perversity of the job, really. If you love motorbikes, you like going quick. But your job was to stop other people from doing it. So it was all momentum. It was all, his life was very practical and all about surging forward. And being an invalid, being in bed for weeks and months, meant that he was stopped, he's stuck. As he said to me later in life, he had time, a lot of time to think and a lot of time to consider his life and what life was. Obviously this guy, and he had long, thoughtful conversations that weren't the norm in my suburban existence. Men certainly didn't talk to each other in a considered or at least, you know, even quiet or even tender way that I heard through the door. And I think it was a transformative experience for my father. I mean, and it certainly was for me. I learnt lots of lessons about strangers. Strangers aren't someone to fear. They're the stranger who can derail your life can be followed by a stranger who can heal your life or help set you on a path to some kind of viable future. You know, gave us some confidence back, and the fact that someone cared. There was, you know, the just the practical compassion of that, a person who we never had that much to do with him later in life. But yeah, Mum and Dad became very devout evangelical Christians, and I've had mail from that man's grandson in the last few years, and they didn't know that story about my father, but I think that guy did lots of things like that. So it was nice that they're really proud of that.
You've written about how your family's church growing and how Christianity affects your writing. You write about the importance of narrative to religion and how church taught you the beauty of and the power of language, the occult power of metaphor, you put it. It's a beautiful way to put it. I mean, the Bible is, the St. James version of the Bible is one of the most beautifully written books there is. And somehow that, it spurred you on. It found your literary soul.
In a way, yeah, because, you know, we were low people employing high language. My parents were taken out of school at 14 or 15. We didn't know anybody who'd finished high school, and we certainly never met anybody who had a university degree. So we were this lumping white trash getting all inspired by high language, and that was really uncommon in suburban Australia in the 60s. Yeah, it formed the bedrock, really, of my respect for language, because language in my lifetime has been liberating. It's opened worlds to me as a reader, and it's opened worlds to me as a writer. It's because of the power of language and what it can open you up to that, you know, here I am, the son of a copper, a bourgeois. I'm a bourgeois because of art. I write novels and get paid for them. I mean, nobody in my family, we didn't. That was just, unforeseeable.
And it was an accident, in fact, that made you start writing. After you had your own accident, you wrote, I think, 3 books before you graduated?
Yeah, it certainly gave me a hurry up. I was coming home from a birthday party, a suburban birthday party, one evening, and I don't remember anything until I woke up in hospital. But we went through the front wall of a girls' school, and the only thing that stopped us from going through the caretaker's house was the concrete base of the rotary clothes hoist. So I ended up with several tons of bricks and a V8 engine more or less in my lap. Yeah, my life was different after that. I always wanted to be a writer. I mean, I wanted to be a writer since I was 10. It's not that I wanted to be a writer. I declared that I was going to be a writer, you know, the arrogance of that. I didn't even meet a writer until I was 18 or 19. But I wanted to be a writer, and I went to university as a scam, really, because I did a creative writing degree where I could be in the back shed pretending to be a student, and really I was just writing short stories and novels. And that was a way that my parents could understand, oh, he's at uni. He's at the uni, as they used to say, you know, and he's studying. Don't bother him. And I'd be out there doodling away and, you know, trying to write a short story. Yeah, after the accident, I took it. I mean, I was pretty keen, but I think I was drifting a little bit, and I wasn't in the kind of hurry that I think I needed to be, you know, to work hard. And I didn't have a plan B after the accident, because I'd always thought that, okay, no one makes any money writing fiction. I mean, you don't have to be a Philistine to utter that sentence, because it's actually by and large true. But I thought, oh, look, you know, I can work on building sites. I'm a strong fella. I can work on a lobster boat and throw pots. After I woke up in hospital, there was no way I could do that kind of work and sustain it for longer than a couple of days. So I just thought, well, that's it, no plan B. The alternative is getting a job like in the public service or being a teacher, like my parents would have dreamt that I was going to be an English teacher or a primary school teacher. My sister had to do that for me. Yeah, so that was it. It was go hard or go home, and that's what I did. I wrote, and I loved it. I enjoyed it. I just couldn't believe that people were letting me do it.
And the world loves it. I mean, your books are so tremendously popular.
Yeah, and I still can't believe that they let me get away with it. Don't get me wrong, it's hard work, and it isn't always fun, but I know, because of my background, I know what labour is worth, and I know that when you work hard for something, there's dignity in that, and that's worth respecting regardless of what you do. So I'm quite unapologetic about being a writer. And it took me a few years to own that without being embarrassed about being dreamy, impractical, maker of nothing. And I'm proud to be a maker of nothings. I make useless things. The novel is a useless artifact. That beauty doesn't need an excuse to exist. And beauty, it has a kind of utility, but it's not worth arguing for. It's good enough that it is. Stories transport us. I don't think we need an excuse for pleasure and for transport. Transport in the old sense. So, yeah, I'm quite at peace with being a tradesman in the business of uselessness.
Your neighbours for a long time didn't know what you did and, in fact, thought you did nothing or at least perhaps might be, you know, in the herbal business.
Yeah, well, I had long hair and I had a very extensive veggie garden and no visible means of support. You know, everyone else in town was a lobster fisherman or a, I guess you could understand it. It was logical. You know, he's you know, growing weed. And I didn't even smoke the stuff. It was like, really? You don't? Me? And then, they saw me on the telly one day at some big national current affairs program. And, that was really odd. Then it was like, oh, Timmy, didn't realise. Is that what you're up to? You know, in a way, I'd loved it until that point because I had really enjoyed living where people didn't give a rat's about what I did and didn't overvalue what I did. And I struggle when I've had to live in the inner city where people overvalue arts work. Don't get me wrong, I'm passionate about the arts and about art and about useless beauty. But really, sometimes they just need to get their hand off it. You know, that's just there are other important things, you know, And also didn't want to write into a sort of warm bath of furious agreement, sort of enclaves of sameness that people seem to form. And it's quite useful to be a writer in a community where your political views are almost diametrically opposed to almost everybody in town, where what you do is of no importance or at least hard for them to get their heads around. Writing into the sort of more of indifference, I think, is useful. You don't make any assumptions. You just don't assume that the people are going to be interested or they're going to like it or they feel the need to pay you attention.
Although, you know, pretty bizarre when they're licking the back of your head when they're when you're made into a stamp.
Which is the great thing is, you know, in Australia and obviously in the UK as well, you know, any opportunity to give someone the chance to take the piss, you know, it's your duty as a family member, you know. Oh, the burden of it. But, so it's an odd thing. I've always liked the thing I'd treasured almost above everything except for my privacy, which I'm almost obsessed about, is unselfconsciousness. I really enjoyed not being able to walk down the street and be normal, be in the same way every kid craves crossing the playground and not sticking out. And that's gone from me. So that's something I mourn a little bit, just unselfconsciousness, walking into a cafe or a deli or something where no one's going to turn their head or ask for a selfie. But it's not that much of a burden. I mean, you trade that off against having to get a real job, you know.
And I guess
blazing sun.
You have your surfing too. And in fact, you've written about how surfing is meditative, a little like religion and also a little like writing, I suppose.
Yeah, it is. It's an odd analogy, really, and I'm half embarrassed to be trotting it out again. But an old bloke who's since died used to live in the town that I lived in. He walked his dog on the beach and we'd drive down onto the sand and go out from there. And I was putting my board back in the back of my car. He said, Timmy, you know, I walk past here every day and I look out at you blokes, I'm sure he said, and you're never doing anything. You're just sitting there looking out to sea, just bobbing around like tea bags. And I thought, well, as surfers, you know, I thought, well, actually, you know, he's right. You know, that's mostly what we do. We sit there and wait. And that's what I do as a novelist. I show up at the desk and I sit there and wait. The surfer waits for a wave, and a swell is the energy from an event in the past over the horizon. The swell's fan out from, you know, a high-energy event, a storm, say. and they fan out and they cross oceans, and then they finally have to land somewhere, so they end up on a beach. And there we are, sitting there waiting for something, and you see this dark line on the horizon, and you get ready. We're all like pups, you know, everyone's up and ready to go. And the job of a surfer is to turn around, match the speed of the line of swell that's running, and ride the energy, get to your feet and ride the energy to the beach. And I thought about it. I mean, I think that's a nutty analogy, but it's probably true. I sit there at the desk. A story is energy radiating from the past, from an event that I don't really understand, that's not in my time zone. And I sit there waiting and waiting. And when something shows up, I try and match its speed, and I ride that energy for as long as that takes, whether it's that afternoon, that day, that year, those 5 years, as long as it takes to ride that energy. So it's about persistence, and it's boring. There's less sun damage sitting at a desk than there is sitting out on a board. But everything looks the same. Every wave to a non-surfer looks like a repetition, every surfed wave. I can understand why people who are not riders would think that every story and every book is just a kind of repetition. You just go through a formula and knock it out at the end. But every wave is different, and every story is a different problem.
And The Shepherd's Hut is unlike most of your other books because it's not set near water. It's not Perth-based. It's actually in the salt lands. The protagonist is this deeply damaged boy, Jaxie Clacton. He's been horribly abused by his father, and that toxic masculinity is something that you've addressed publicly. Why do you think that so many men grow up emotionally stunted?
I think it's modelling. I think it's what they know. It's how they've been taught to be a man. I don't think there's anything intrinsically male about glowering silence, but it's so common to see, to witness and to experience. You know, I think we all come into the world with a relatively similar spectrum of emotions and behaviours and abilities, and we respond to the stimulus around us. We learn from watching those of us who are, you know, those in our family who are older, or those in, you know, at school or whatever. You unconsciously adopting. You see someone getting punished for one form of expression. So you note to self, best not do that. So it's almost as though, you know, kids all show up with a box of coloured pencils, you know, in infancy. And, you know, you as a little boy, you're allowed to do a lot of things. You're allowed to do almost anything. You can, up to a certain age, and then they start taking the pencils off you. They take yellow and red and orange off you. By the time you're 11, you're down to the blacks and the blues and the purple and, you know, by the time you're 17, it's all the dark colours. You're not allowed to do certain things. You know, you can't kiss your father goodbye. You wouldn't hold another boy's hand. You couldn't express any softness. All the things that are actually part of being a boy, you know, that we associate with exclusively feminine traits, they're boys as well. They're just, boys get robbed of them. And we wonder why they're sort of silent, seething, raging little savages, when we cross the street to avoid them down the high road.
The Shepherd's Hut is written in the voice of the 15-year-old Jaxie, and obviously you're not 15 anymore.
No, but
it seemed to me that there was a lot in common with the kind of childhood you've described, Jaxie's working class, for instance, and this boy that you write about so beautifully. This book has been compared to Huckleberry Finn, and I can completely see why. And I think it deserves the reputation that Huckleberry Finn has too. It really is that book, but for our generation.
Oh well, that's nice of you to say. I certainly didn't have Huck Finn in mind, but then I grew up on Tom Sawyer and Huckleberry Finn and also Stevenson, you know, Kidnapped and Treasure Island. So those authors and those books are, I suppose, always on my shoulder looking over. And I didn't set out to write about a, you know, 15-year-old foul-mouthed sociopath. He just showed up uninvited and unwelcome, to be honest. I was writing another book entirely, and this scene just popped into my mind. like a memory. It was so authentic, so convincing that it was as if I'd remembered it. But it was the scene where he comes in and finds his father crushed under the car, and I heard his voice. I was in his mind saying it, if you know what I mean. It's hard to explain, but his voice was right there. And I jotted it down, irritated, and put it aside and tried to go back to my novel. And within 4 or 5 days, I've completely derailed from the novel that I was on. And I just went and followed that voice to find out who he was and what that was about. And yeah, there's a lot of similarities in terms of the working class background and stuff. And, you know, and the vernacular that people spoke. But he's a very different boy from me. I mean, there's no love in his life. There's no nurture. I mean, our mother and father gave us license to be different kinds of boys and girls to some of the other kids that we knew. We didn't quite understand that until we were teenagers. But I used to come home from school and with a friend, and you know, to go and raid the fridge. I could just get the sense that my friend had stopped behind me, silent. I look over my shoulder and standing there with an open mouth. He's looking at my father in his police duds, and he's stripped down. The tunic was off. He was wearing a singlet or a vest, as you'd say here. And he's doing the ironing in front of Coronation Street, but the handcuffs hanging off the end of the end of the thing and the end of the ironing board, and the truncheon sort of swinging there with my baby brother trying to reach the truncheon, you know. And I didn't think a thing of it. I mean, I was normal to see, you know, your father, the police sergeant, doing the dishes, knew how to work the washing machine. He was not much of a cook, but if he saw that was help needed to be done, you know, you help people out. There was no skirt work in our family, as it used to be called, in the wider family and in the neighbourhood. Oh, no, I can't do that, mate. That's skirt work.
What is your next work, skirt or otherwise?
I'm going to go back and see if I can salvage the thing that I forsook for Jaxie. Jaxie's one of those kids that you wouldn't let him in your house and you wouldn't give him a lift. And I wouldn't recommend living with him in your head for a couple of years. I'm grateful for the experience, but I'm glad to be able to step out of his world, you know. I mean, I hope for the best for him. I mean, I really do hope that he finds peace and makes peace, but he needs a bit of getting over from my end.
Tim, thank you so much. Tim Winton's most recent book is The Shepherd's Hut. He's published by Picador. You've been listening to Meet the Writers, thanks to the production team of George McDonough, Christy Evans and Mariana Lagrasta. You can download this show and previous episodes from our website or app, from SoundCloud, MixCloud or iTunes. I'm Georgina Godwin. Thank you for listening.